Session number 13651, reel number one.
Mr. Pete, reel one. Were you born in Hull, Mr. Pete?
Yes, I was born Seaton Grove, West Hull.
Whereabouts is that?
In Old City's ground, North
yes.
Road. Well, it's off there, just off there.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a labourer on the fish dock.
Can you give me your date of birth, please?
11th of October, 1924.
And your full name?
Raymond Pete.
Did you go to school in West Hull?
Yes, not the school that was bombed. Yes, no, Francis Askew School, North Road.
So you're a schoolboy when war broke out?
I'd just started work in 1939.
Where had you started work?
At the Premier Oil and Cape Mills, and I remained there. It was taken over by Croda International. So I remained there 48 years.
Did you hear Chamberlain make the announcement that
were
at war with Germany?
Yes. I was in church on Ezel Road at the time, and then I've had recordings since late. I was at at church with the Boy Scouts.
Were you all listening to the wireless?
No, that would be. We were actually in the service when the announcement was made, and then we heard it afterwards. Yeah.
How did you feel about the outbreak of war?
Well, I think being younger, you didn't think like older. I mean, I came home from church, and the mother, she was in tears. She said that they were only just getting over the First World War. My father lost a son in the First World War as well as the Second World.
Now, you joined the cyclists to help the air raid wardens. Can you tell me when and how all that came about, please?
Yes, it was as a member of the Boy Scouts. We were asked to volunteer, and we had to report to Wellington Group Scouts. They was one of the biggest in West Hull. They were above a shop in on Ezel Road, and I went there, and I was given the job of filling sandbags. And then eventually I was posted to a warden's post on Ezel High Road. The posts then were made of sandbags, and the job was to see that people kept their blackouts on, and also they collected the names of everybody in every house in their district, and they asked people to let them know when anybody came to stay or anybody went away, so they had a record of everybody in their area, which paid off marvellously later in the air raids, of course, because they knew who to look for.
Who was the air raid warden you were helping?
I don't know his name. He was at, I think it was District 23. They had a house on Ezel High Road. Their headquarters were on Ezel High Road.
Did you have to provide your own bike?
Oh, yes, you had to ride your own bike, because one night I was that tired I walked home and then realised I'd left my bike there. Oh, yes.
Did you have any kind of uniform or insignia?
No, we eventually got a band to go around our arms. The actual uniforms didn't come in till, I would say, the end of 1941, 42. So when the blitzes were on, there was no uniforms. There perhaps were overalls, but the uniforms didn't come in at that time till after the main blitzes.
So could a cyclist messenger be distinguished as he was biking about?
Oh, we had a helmet with an M on. That was a black helmet with a white M. And then if you were a district leader, it was a white helmet with a black M. And also we had a bicycle lamp with the letter M on it. This was to enable people to help us to find incidents or wherever we're going. You'd get policemen shouting that to see if they could help you when you were going to an incident or carrying a message.
Did any girls volunteer?
Oh, we had one or two girls in the civil, it was ARP, of course, at first, and it was there were girl messengers, but we didn't have any girl messengers at our first aid post. I came across them later when I went to control.
What about the ambulances which you had?
The ambulances were more like little vans that were with a body part filled on, built on it, with a stretch, a couple of stretchers in, and they were very uncomfortable things because the works broke, and they caused a lot of pain. And also, of course, this meant that the driver and attendants were had to move slowly during the air raids because otherwise they would create a lot of pain.
So they were just a scratch affair, were they?
Oh, yes, they were.
Now, what was the first raid that you remember?
Well, the first raid I went out to was in Argyle Street, and it was 18th and 19th of March, 41. And it was one of the first heavy raids, and it was thick fog. And I reported for duty, and when you reported for duty, there was a blackboard, and parties were built up by putting names on to build up parties ready for going out as they arrived. And also, there was one messenger allocated to each ambulance. At the Argyle Street incident, it was only a small incident, and I wasn't one of the first to arrive like other incidents, but it was my first one, and I found it terrifying. I set off in thick fog. The guns and machine guns were firing, and in those days the big guns, you could hear the, though there's usually a flash before, you could hear the shell go over, but later on in the war they stopped the flash, so you just heard the shell zoom over you, the big ones. And as I went down Enderby Road in the thick fog, and of course I was getting more and more terrified because I could hardly move, and there was shrapnel coming down, and I rode up to the wheels of a train, a passenger train, that had crashed through the gates near Boulevard. And this in itself was terrifying, to ride right up to the wheels in the thick fog. And then I heard a noise, and I found a divisional officer had joined me, and he'd already been knocked off his bike, and he said, come on, Ray, he said, we've got to get around this. And we went further up the track, and as we came back at the other side, there was a big crater at the side of the train and under the road, but I never saw any people. And then I continued to Argyle Street, and as I turned into Argyle Street, I saw the ambulances that had arrived, and I thought, what on earth have I let myself in for? Because training had been very friendly and quite comical with some of the names, really, but now this was the real thing. And as I arrived at the incident, my brother handed me a bundle and asked me to look after it, and it was a dead baby. And I was petrified then and terrified.
How had the baby been killed?
I don't know. I've no record of that other than my brother. I know they were looking in, digging to get a shelter that had gone partly under the ground. That's what I was told as I left the post. But he handed it to me and I stood with it, and then somebody yelled at me to get rid of it and to get rid in, go into the next street where a lady was supposed reported as being trapped. I put the baby in the back of one of our car ambulances. We had a couple of cars that we used for sitting patients, and I put it in the back of one of those, and then I set off for Gladstone Street, and as I left, I saw a doctor from a nearby hospital. It was Western General Hospital then. Give a boy morphine, and then an unexploded bomb in a terrace nearby went off, killing two people. But as I went up Argyle Street, I was being covered in shrapnel, and I got onto Andover Road, and there was nowhere to get cover, and I put my arms around the traffic light to try and get some cover. And but of course that was useless. The traffic lights actually worked through the air raids. They were covered up a lot, but they actually worked through the air raids. And I went down Gladstone Street, and I found a woman partly trapped in the wall of a house, and there was also a baby there. Both of them were alive, and as I approached them, a youth who was kneeling down near them, he jumped up and ran away, terrified, and I never found out who he was.
Why should he have been terrified?
I suppose it was the circumstances. It was terrifying, what were the bombs and the shrapnel and the fog. And in my case, it was my first time. And perhaps he'd never been to one before. And then I was able to get this woman. She was just in the wall. I was able to just pull her out of the wall, and I put the baby in a basket type thing that was there. And then the other men with the ambulances arrived with a stretcher, and I was then told to go back to the crater on Andover Road because they'd sent for another ambulance, and I was to watch at this crater. The divisional officer told me to lay down because it was so dangerous with the shrapnel and that, and stop this ambulance from going into the crater, assuming that it was coming up Boulevard. And it arrived with a man sat on the bonnet because it was thick fog. As you imagine, I was absolutely terrified. I honestly thought that I'd gone down below, really. I was so frightened. But then I was told to get back to the post, and on the way I called in a relative in Melrose Street, and she just took one look at me and she thought I'd been hurt in her head. Your stomach used to swell and you used to more or less force you to go to toilet, and anyhow, I wasn't hurt. But then I went back, of course, to the post, and when I got there I was told I had arrived back in the best condition of anybody, but I didn't let on that I'd been in this, called at this house for a few minutes. Just looking at this relative, it calmed me down and made me realise that I was normal. But that was my first incident, and I'll never forget that.
What was the next one you remember?
The next one was in April 41. We were sent to bomb houses in Willoughby Road. and to Wadham Road, where Warden had been hit with a shrapnel.
This was the 20th and 25th of April.
April, yes. Then the next one.
Anything you remember about those? The Willoughby Road and Hotham Road?
No, not that I've got written down, and if I haven't got it written down, really, I don't leave it to my memory and that. We had the post, we had two stretchers with wheels on, a couple of wheels on. And when the ambulances were all out, somebody would take the stretcher. I know it was used at Hotham Road and it was used on Pickering High Road in place of ambulance until we could get an ambulance back.
Now, can you tell me about the night of the 24th, 25th of April? Because that was an important trade.
That was. The siren sounded at 21:39 hours, and at 23:30 hours, a huge explosion shook the post, and it actually moved people that were stood up. And the post leader, like, realising that the phones would be out of order, he sent three of us messengers. That was my brother Jim, Jack Lilly and myself, into different areas off North Road to see if we could find where the bomb had dropped. And I actually came across it myself down Council Avenue, and I came across a great mound of soil and with electric lights running across it, or flashes running across it. So I suppose in those days electricity must have been on pause. And then I heard a woman shouting at the other side of this mound, and I went to her, and she grabbed me arm, and she kept saying to me, "Where is God? Where is God?" And she grabbed me and took me behind what was remained of her house, and in the garden was the body of her son, Jim Thrussell, I think his name was. And also there was a body of a man. Whether it was her husband or not, I don't know.
How old was the son about?
16. Remember that clearly. He was 16.
Was it blessed that had killed him?
As far as I understood from the wardens afterwards, he'd seen a parachute coming down, and he thought that it was a man on the parachute, but it wasn't. It was a bomb, one of these bombs. Well, and I was joined by my brother, and he told me that help was on the way, and the wardens had got a message through, and so help was on the way. And then the policeman arrived, Police Sergeant number 216. He arrived and placed a paraffin lamp on the branches of a tree, which they did. And the glass of the lamp was coloured blue, so everybody could identify him as the incident officer. And he wrote down our names and recorded everything we did. Everything we did, we had to report to him. On arrival at the incident, our first aid post leader, Norman Dick, asked me to go into a shelter with him, an Anderson shelter, which had been hit by blast, and help him to pass out four people inside who were injured. This often happened when people were laid in a shelter and the shelter got hit, it would hit their heads, you know, as the shelter moved with the blast. And one lady, she had terrible injuries, head injuries. And when her daughter saw, her daughter was stood outside and she was perfectly clean, so she She hadn't been right at the incident. She became so shocked that they had to take her to hospital. And at this point, a wall crashed down, and there was a roll call held to see if any of us were hurt. And two of our men were hurt, George Fretmer and Eric Windsor, both found to have serious injuries.
Was this man with the unusual name of German origin?
I have no idea. No, no idea. See, at the post were all so friendly, you know, they were all volunteers, and it was such a friendly post.
When you say about people being injured in the air raid shelters, you mean the walls would vibrate with the blast?
Yeah, there
and
would.
Anybody who was too near would be injured?
That's right, especially if they were laid down, because their heads would be near the wall. Yeah. And then we heard screams from what remained of another house, and I followed my brother into this house, and we saw that a man was trapped. Again, it trapped in the wall, which often happened, in the wall, and he was on fire. And they got a stirrup pump and sprayed him. He said to us, his daughter was in the house. Well, the house was nearly wrecked. And but he then said that my brother was stood on her, and we found her underneath, in the rubble underneath my brother. And she lived, but he didn't live, he died. Yeah. Now then, this started a human chain of buckets of water from damaged houses to help us to put out these small fires. There was no big fire. And as we were doing this, the Germans must have gone over inland. And so it became a bit quiet. And these people turned out, mind you, their own houses must have been terribly damaged. All the glass, of course, and other damage. But they got this line of buckets of water from one of the houses. But then the plane started to come back over the city from inland, and all these people disappeared, left us. And I often thought, like, it's the people that are organised. It's very important to be organised, because of course we didn't go away, we had to stop there, but these people, of course, were able to. It's something that's always reminded me of that. And then they were shouting to a lady under a house that had collapsed inwards with this landmine. It did all sorts of strange things. And she shouted that she was under the stairs with her three children, and that she wasn't hurt. And I was then told to go and fetch six more rescue parties. And I've still got my message book through there with the messages in. I was unable to telephone the message from a nearby warden's post because the phones were out of action. So I cycled to Gordon Street Police Station, which at that part of the wall was the South West Control Centre. And as I cycled past the rescue depot down Boulevard, they saw the M on me cycle and shouted if they could do anything to help me. And anyhow, then I got to the police station, and the police sergeant was just coming out, and he took me inside and he handed in the message. And and then back at the incident, I found that Dr. Moyes, He was a doctor that often went out with us from the post. He was talking through the ruins to the buried family, and we could smell gas. Rescue workers, they were lowered down into the centre of the house, that with the gas they started to vomit, and so they couldn't stay in there very long, and then other rescue men would go in, and the men that was pulled out, they were walked down the groves, River Grove and those groves. And at 02:30 hours, the incident officer gave me the following message to take to report centre. Escape of gas, 91 Council Avenue. Send coal gas service, Council Avenue, Lakeside Grove, urgent. And then on a returning, I was given another message. Mr. Moulton, telephone 32518, Councillor Smith says, telephone fire station and ask for Novak's breathing apparatus to be sent. Later in the war, this apparatus was allocated to all control centres.
What did it consist of?
It was a little case with a cylinder in and a mask.
A cylinder of oxygen?
That was what it would be, yeah. It was, I know it was called the Novak's breathing apparatus. And it was brought to the incident by the civilian ambulance. At 02:55 hours, I took a further message. Incident off Lakeside Grove. Coal gas service not arrived. Urgently required this incident. Police Sergeant 216 Incident Officer. I was then told to go back to the first aid post for arrest as I was breathing an amount of gas, and I was sent home at 04:50 hours with a request to report at 10:00 hours to District HQ, Warden's District HQ 23, to help with bombed out families. It was a Saturday, and so I didn't have to go to work. When I was reporting, I was given messages to take out about bombed out people, and met my old headmaster, Mr. G.R. Rice. Headmasters were such important people to young people in those days, but he insisted that he took some of the messages for me because he so much wanted to help. Now, the Trapp family, although they'd been unhurt, they were dead with the gas when reached. They were unmarked.
Was this raid worse than the Argyle Street one that you went to?
Well, I was more used to it. I didn't have all the terror and horror that I did the first time, even though I was one of the first there, if not the first there. But it had helped me to get over that first incident. And the bombing wasn't so heavy at this incident. But I noticed I was kept pretty well occupied as well with messages.
Now, there was an earlier raid in March 1941 concerning Liverpool Street, which I think is off Holness.